Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickard. Glad to be with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, we talk about the human rights group KARMA, an educational organization that focuses on the domestic and global issues of human rights for Muslim women. This summer, KARMA held their 7th annual Law and Leadership Program, which brings together delegates from all over the world. There were delegates from Canada, Belgium, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. The program gives women the tools to effect positive change in their home countries and promote understanding in the Western world. We're joined this morning by Aziza Al-Hibre. She's a professor of law at the T.C. Williams School of Law at the University of Richmond, and she founded the women's rights group KARMA in 1993 and currently serves as its president. We're also working on one more guest who we hope will be joining us in just a moment or two. Her name is Rahila Muhibi, and she is a recent graduate of Methodist University in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and the founder of the 100 Mothers Literacy Program. So hopefully she'll be with us in just a bit. And you can call us this morning with your questions and your own stories for our guest at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. And it looks like we do have Rahila Muhibi with us. Great. And I want to welcome you both. Thank you for being with us.
We're happy to be online with you.
Well, thank you so much. Well, Aziza Al-Hibre, let's start with you. Tell us about the birth of KARMA. How did this organization get going?
Well, you remember in the early 90s, that was the decade for women at the United Nations. And there was a lot of discussion about Muslim women and talk about Islam denying them their rights. I had been involved in the 60s in the women's movement from the academic side, in philosophy and women's studies. And when I heard this kind of discussion, I was informed by my prior experience and decided that Muslim women ought to speak in their own voice, and therefore KARMA was born. And the important thing about KARMA is that it tries to restudy religion and peel away from it the patriarchal elements that have invaded it over centuries and explain it in a way that is more gender equitable. And that turned out to be a long process, but not really difficult to do because we have all the basics in the ancient sources, which were a lot less patriarchal than what we find in the last 500 years.
Well, give me an example of some of those patriarchal vestiges that you're trying to peel away.
Oh, well, for example, one very easy point to illustrate. Many medieval jurists argued that since, according to the Quran, the marriage between a male and female is one of tranquility, affection, and mercy, then the marriage contract itself is about companionship. It's not a service contract. And therefore, it should not include housekeeping, ironing, cooking. All these things are services that the Muslim woman is not required to do in the marriage contract. Now, that was the better interpretation, and that's the interpretation that we adopt today. However, there have been some jurists who argued that even if this is the case, then since Islam does not reject the cultures in which it is adopted, then they argued that since the culture requires the wife to do housework, then they would require the wife to do housework regardless. And they put that in the family law of their countries. So that is a patriarchal influence that was brought into the law by culture, but without the distinction, because once it is in the law, you don't know what's the origin of the law. Is it religious or is it cultural? Hmm. And so a lot of Muslim women for a long time assumed that to be a good wife, that's required of them. Well, it is not, and we're telling them that.
Well, I'm curious about what you said. You said it hadn't proved as difficult as you thought to peel away some of these patriarchal overlays. I would think it would be incredibly different. And from what I've read in certain places, you know, where cultures favor a conservative interpretation of these laws, it would be something that would be hard to shed.
Well, to change is different. We're talking about developing a feminist, or I shouldn't say feminist, a gender equitable jurisprudence. I mean, we're not trying to be feminists here. We're just trying to say, what does the Quran and the sources secondary to it say? And to look at that, it's not that difficult to peel away the patriarchal elements. For example, when they take a verse in the Quran or in the Hadith, the statements of the Prophet, and they add to it the assumption that since women are irrational and weak and emotional, then this is the rule we're going to adopt. You can easily recognize that what they've added is to the religious law is a patriarchal assumption that's going to result in a wholly different result. We strip away the patriarchal assumption, which is personal or cultural to them, and we stick to the original. Once you do that, you can easily get a more gender equitable result.
And are you able to change that into law?
That's a whole different story. That is the difficult part.
Okay.
Not the interpretation. But remember, you cannot change anything unless you have the groundwork, which is the interpretation itself. So the first step is to have these interpretations, have them known by women so that their consciousness will change, so that they know that they're not standing up against the religion or the divinity if they decide to say, I don't want to cook in the house, or, you know, if I cook, that is not a volunteer work, that is work. And a lot of jurists in medieval times said that if she works in the home, she's entitled to pay. You know, that was way ahead of what the feminist movement in the 60s said. So if the Muslim woman starts understanding that she has all these rights and her consciousness changes, that is really step one in changing society. And educating women on these issues and then making them active is the way to do it. The change in the law is not going to happen overnight, but it's starting to happen. Morocco, for example, had wonderful changes in the law a few years ago. I think some of you are aware of it, where the financial rights of the Muslim women are spelled out. For example, in Islam, the Muslim woman who enters the marriage does not lose control over her money. The Muslim woman, from the time she becomes an adult, just like the man, has full control and full identity as a financially responsible person in control of her finances. Her father, her brother, her husband cannot lay hands on that. So, you know, many women don't understand that. Even in the United States, and I'm telling you this because we're not just talking about helping women overseas. We're trying to help women in the U.S. and Europe, Muslim women who work hard and give their money to the husband or to the joint marital property. And then at one point, the husband decides he wants a different wife, and, you know, she ends up without the money and destitute. And I've seen a lot of cases like that. Now, you might ask, how could that be in the U.S., given that she's entitled to equitable distribution of the marital property or community property or something like that? The answer to that is that the Islamic marriage contract has been interpreted by some guys who went to court as a prenuptial agreement, which is an erroneous, totally erroneous way of looking at it. But as a result, since the contract has a marital gift in it, a financial marital gift, just like the, let's say, the diamond ring in the Western tradition, in the Islamic tradition, he has to give a gift to the wife, and she could decide whether it's going to be money or it's going to be something non-material. But usually women like to get something material as a way to improve their financial situation. That is a marital gift to you at the time of marriage, but sometimes for cultural reasons they have agreed they could delay it till the day of divorce or death of the husband. They will delay a part of it, not all of it. So he could pay $1 up front and maybe $500,000 later. Usually it's not that large an amount. It's usually much less.
I want to follow up on something you said a while ago. You said that as you try to reinterpret the law and the Quran to be a more gender equitable thing, you said we're not trying to be feminists. Why not?
Well, because the word, let me tell you something. When I was in active in the 60s, the word feminist was a very nice thing to be. And then I went into school and came out, and suddenly, for some reason, the new generation of women I teach, the first thing they say, and these are not Muslim women, these are the general new generation of young women I talk to, the first thing they want to tell me is that they're not feminist. Hmm. The meaning of feminist seems to have changed.
Well, I know that's changed.
It seems that they're not aware of all the privileges that they are enjoying because of what we did in the 60s.
Well, I know that's changed a bit, you know, in non-Muslim populations in America as well. Women don't want to call themselves feminists as well, but if you consider, you know, the term to its origins, just being women's advocacy, it's
I have
striking.
No problem with that. I just don't want to get caught into a word war.
Right.
All I'm doing is something very clear and very traditional. I'm trying to get back to the original interpretation of the Quran and the other sources and get out of it the patriarchal assumptions that are contrary to the spirit of the Quran and get it to be what it is.
Well,
here's what I want to tell you. I do not have an axe to grind. In other words, when I go into interpretation, I don't tell myself, as a good scholar, not a Muslim scholar, but any scholar, I don't tell myself, this is the result I want to end up with, and therefore I'm going to twist and turn the text to fit my result. That's not what I do. I look at the text and strip away the patriarchal influences and look at what is left. And what is left is usually gender equitable. And that's what I was trying to tell you. There is no agenda here ahead of time to say, let's twist and turn the meanings to our interest. This is a serious scholarly activity, and it comes out fine.
Well, I want to make sure we get our other guest in on it. Now we've got her on the line. Ruhila Muhibi, hi. Thanks for being with us and waiting so patiently.
Thank you.
Ruhila, you were part of the 7th Annual Law and Leadership Program put on by Karma. Could you tell us about your experience there?
Yes. I would like to thank you, Dr. Al-Hibri, for providing that opportunity for Muslim women to come from all over the world and educate themselves about Quran. And we are usually very much misunderstood, as she said. Our rights are misunderstood. I came from Afghanistan to Karama, and with thinking to learn more, because I had the faith that Quran will not be, Quran is not an unfair religion, or Islam is not an unfair religion. So I always questioned myself at why there is so much unfairness and unjustness towards women in Afghanistan, and I grew up with it. So one of the reasons that I came to Karama was this, to really learn for my rights and to really learn how this will help me to educate myself and also to stand for other women who would like to be free from these stereotypes. So it was a great experience, and I actually learned a lot of things that I never knew before about Quran. I learned that there are 25 cases, 23 cases where women inherit money or whatever property they inherit from their parents, equal to or more than men, and there's only one case that they inherit less, but in my society where I grew up, there's only this only one case is practiced, and not the other 23 cases. So these things are very enlightening for me to learn more about, and there are other issues as well about how, as Dr. Hibri said, that how we are not required to stay at home, and we are not required to just cook and take care of the household. We can do that voluntarily, but we don't have to be forced, pressured, or beaten up for doing it. Or we shouldn't be demanded to do that, or we shouldn't give up our dreams to do those things. And women are really equal to men.
Well, Ruhila, I want to ask you.
I
want to ask you about the program you founded in 2008, the 100 Mothers Literacy Program. Tell us about that and how that came about.
I actually did a pilot project in Afghanistan during my school year. I went back to Afghanistan in 2007, and I opened a school, not a school, but it was a youth summer camp for Afghan students to just bring them together, and they should learn from each other and kind of develop that relationship between each other. So So I took them to my home village in Afghanistan, and I haven't been to that village for a very long time. Mm. And then coming to U.S. and Canada and studying here, and I realized that I have a duty to go back and also not to just copy what is done in Western society and implement it in Afghanistan, but also kind of integrate what I learned from here and what I have in Afghanistan and put them together and offer them to my community. So when I went to the village, and I had a few Afghan women and mothers that they were working for the project. I saw a lot of dreams in their eyes. They always wished that they were like me, educated, but the fact that they didn't believe that they can be educated hurt me a lot. And that's when I really decided to open the 100 Mothers Literacy Program to teach them how to read and write in Persian, and that way they can be independent in future, and they can teach their children, and also their boys, their sons, can grow up looking at their mothers as a educated image, rather than mm-hmm. an uneducated image of a mother who is just in the household, takes care of the household.
What changes have you seen in these women as the program progresses?
Well, in the village, there has never been a school before, and no women in that village have gone to school in the history of the whole Afghanistan. It wasn't just that the schools were shut during the Taliban, but in the village where I was growing up, there was no school at all, whether it was during the Taliban, before the Taliban, or it hasn't been a school at all. So these women don't really believe that they can learn or they can use their literacy skills. So it was very hard for us for the first 3 months to bring that confidence to them and tell them and bring examples of how other women in the cities that they went to literacy schools, how they learn how they use their skills. So it has been quite successful, not as much as I expected to, but looking into their background and how there was no opportunity for them to be able to even think of going to school, but now they're actually considering to learn and to go to school. That's a big step for us that's a big achievement for now. But we just finished our 6 month of the training.
Mm, congratulations. It sounds like a wonderful program. And you're only in your 24 or 25?
24.
24, right. And I've read that you're the first one in your clan to go to college and get a college degree. Is that right? And I understand you're facing some pressure from your family to go back to Afghanistan to honor a marriage betrothal to a cousin, and that you're a little reluctant to do that.
Yeah.
Are you hoping to stay and work on your career and your new organizations, like 100 Mothers Literacy? What is your plan?
I'm going to London to study Islamic studies. I'll be learning more about Islam and about the interpretation of Islam, and that will be my graduate studies. That's why I want to really learn more in order to equip myself with the knowledge and the skills that I need to go back to Afghanistan. And eventually, I really hope to go back to Afghanistan after I get my master's.
Well, let's take a break right now, and then we'll come back and keep talking about the group Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights. We're talking with Aziza Al-Hibre, who is the founder of Karama. She is a professor of law at the T.C. Williams School of Law at the University of Richmond, also Karama's current president. And we're also talking with Rahila Muhibi, who's a recent graduate of Methodist University in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and founder of the 100 Mothers Literacy Program. She's also a participant in the Karama program. And we'd welcome your calls this hour as well, your calls for our guests this morning to maybe dig into some of the questions about how they are reinterpreting the Quran to provide more gender equity in the law and to affect positive change in home countries for Muslim women. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, I hope you'll join us for Talk of the Nation. Today, a program called The Harlem Children's Zone does whatever it takes to help disadvantaged kids in Harlem succeed. But does it work? You can decide for yourself after 1 o'clock on Talk of the Nation. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning, we're talking about the organization Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights. It was founded in 1993, and we're talking with the founder of Karama today, Aziza Al-Hibre, who is a professor of law at the T.C. Williams School of Law at the University of Richmond. Also joining us, Rohila Muhibi. She's a recent graduate of Methodist University in Fayetteville and the founder of the 100 Mothers Literacy Program, which was founded in 2008 to educate women in her home village in Afghanistan. And Aziza Al-Hibre, I want to go back to you. As we were talking with Rohila a moment ago, she was talking about one of the gifts from Karama being the confidence to, I gather, to understand the interpretations of the Quran and the law and how they fit together. And I understand that confidence is something that's very important to Karama, giving women that confidence that they can feel that they make a difference. So how do you think about the role of confidence in affecting the kind of change you're talking about?
It is critical. And confidence does not come without knowledge. And knowledge based on correct information. In fact, we are thinking of doing another program, a more advanced program in the summer, where we take lawyers from various countries, women lawyers, and give them advanced arguments so that they will be able to put forth additional change in their countries. We also have a network unique in the world of jurists, lawyers, and leaders of 450 women around the Middle East and North Africa, and we're adding to it other parts of Asia and Africa. And these jurists also share with us their views, and we're hoping that, we met in Bahrain in a conference last year, and they made some resolutions, and now we are trying to decide where would these resolutions be best offered as a way to change some laws in some countries. So we're going to meet again to decide strategically where we should push these resolutions. The conference was about domestic violence, and the women, were able to come together in almost unanimous decision-making on these resolutions. So hopefully that would be a way to change things as well. I would like to mention that we are not losing touch with Rohila when she moves to London. Karama is also expanding into Europe, and she will be helping us there. A lot of the Muslim women in Europe, especially in Belgium, have been talking to us and wanting Karama to go there to counter some of the thought, conservative patriarchal thought that is spreading over there. And we have educated in our summer program 24 such Muslim women, and they are our ambassadors into Europe. And we will go further and help them in order to educate the Muslim community across the continent there so that the women would see our point of view and understand our arguments and develop the confidence to stand up for their rights. And Europe will be an easier place to make those changes in, I think.
Well, let's go to the phone lines now. I've got some folks waiting to talk to you. And we'll start with Carol calling from Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'd like some questions about marriage laws and custody as it relates to divorce. I'm thinking of marrying a Muslim, and I've heard that the law is that a woman can't divorce her husband unless I think it was for two minor things, but a husband can divorce his wife by just saying, I divorce you in front of a witness. And then the husband, after a certain age, can take custody of the children. And I wonder if that's in the Quran or if that's in a particular country, or what are the rules about divorce?
This is an excellent question, actually. A lot of Muslim women ask it themselves. And the first thing we try to tell them is that the rules of divorce in Islam are very symmetrical as between male and female. They don't know that. And I think if you ask Rahila, she might tell you that she didn't know that she had the right to divorce.
Yeah.
And the way it works out is that the male does have the right to unilaterally initiate divorce against the wife. But the wife has a similar right, and it's called khula. If he initiates the divorce, if he forgoes the marital gift he gave her, it's only fair. If she initiates the divorce, she returns to him his marital gift, because you don't want her to be profiteering from marriage. She does not need a reason for the divorce. Other than that, it's not good for her to stay in it. He does not need a reason for the divorce either, and nobody should ask them, because privacy is very important in Islamic law, especially as between husband and wife. Now, there is a third way in which divorce could happen, and that is where the wife would go to the judge and seek judicial divorce, and that is where she has to show that she is leaving the husband, not arbitrarily, but because he's done something wrong, and this is like 5 reasons: abandonment, non-maintenance, the husband is imprisoned, things like that. And the judge would then give her divorce. The problem has been in the past, in terms of implementation, is that the jurist of, and until today, some of them still continue to assert that the woman cannot exercise her unilateral right of divorce without the consent of the husband. Of course, once you put that condition, you basically took her right away, and the husband could blackmail the woman into a variety of conditions before he would give his consent. In the original tradition, there is no consent requirement. And most recently, several years ago in Egypt, the Al-Azhar, the famous Islamic school, actually accepted the fact that consent is not required, and Egyptian law was changed accordingly. The change in the Egyptian law was fought very hard, because a lot of conservatives argued that not a single woman would remain married if she had the right to divorce her husband, which was really silly, because, it assumed that women were coerced into continuing the marriage. And, of course, once the women got the right to divorce without the consent of the husband, there hasn't been many divorces. But the short answer is that in the U.S., in Europe, in Egypt, and hopefully in the future in some other countries, the Muslim woman can initiate the divorce so long as she's willing to give back the marital gift. And if she thinks she shouldn't give back the marital gift because he has harmed her in some way, for example, in Kuwait, verbal abuse is a form of harm, and therefore she can go to the judge and say, he verbally abused me, he will give her the judge a judicial divorce, and she does not have to return her marital gift. So all of this shows that there are a lot of equivalent rights that women do not know about. And in the U.S., some of the imams do not like to practice this new interpretation. But karama, if somebody tells karama that they need to do khula, divorce, and they cannot find an imam, we will try to find one for them.
Carol, if you marry, will you live in the United States?
No, Egypt.
In Egypt, okay. Did you get your question answered there?
Yes, thank you. The
other
thing
with her custody, she's living in Egypt, that there will be a 6-month wait or so. She has to go before a judge for the khula and wait 6 months just to try to reconcile. And at the end of the 6 months, she can come to the judge and say, I can't reconcile, and he will give her her divorce.
After 6 months.
Something like that. Yeah.
And Carol, I gather you also wanted to have the question about custody of children answered as well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's an interesting case in the U.S. I don't remember the name of the case, but that's where there was a custody battle between two Muslim parents, and it took place in 2 jurisdictions and ended up in the U.S., one in Lebanon, one in the Emirates, and finally in the U.S. The judicial decision in Lebanon and the Emirates were different from each other. In one, there was an automatic change of custody from the child, from the mother to the parent, when the child, whether a daughter or a son, reached a certain age. usually the ages differ from girl to boy. And you find that in a lot of the family laws in Muslim countries. But in the other jurisdiction, I believe it was Lebanon, the judge argued in terms of the best interest of the child and who should therefore get custody. When the case came to the United States, the judge here refused to give comity or accept the judgment in the jurisdiction which went by mechanical age transfer, and instead gave comity and accepted the judgment of the case where the judge looked at the best interest of the child. This is a detailed way of telling you that interpreting custody laws is an art and a science, and in some countries they have decided to go through mechanical age limitation that would automatically change the custody at a certain age from the mother to the father, but that is not true everywhere. And I know in Saudi Arabia there are judges who have sometimes let the son stay with the mother until he matures. And there are judges who ask the child, what do you want to do? So there is not one clear picture, but one thing I can say is that many of the laws have this automatic transfer provision.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Carol, and good luck to you. We'll move on now to Oliver with us from La Crosse. Hi, Oliver.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to... I returned from Afghanistan about a month ago. I was a worked for a company contracted through the Department of State, and our mission over there was... We're all attorneys. One of our missions was... at least a section of the program that I worked for, we had a gender justice support program, and I just wanted to point that out, that, you know, there is that program in Afghanistan, and I was kind of wondering if Ms. Mohibi had heard of that program, whether they worked together, and if not, you know, I'm welcome to offer contact information off the air, of course, for security reasons. But I think that coordination of efforts is obviously an important aspect of this.
Oliver, I'm sorry. Did you say you could tell us the name of the group or not?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the program is called the Justice Sector Support Program. It is a joint. It's a program contracted out jointly by the Department of State and the Bureau of International Narcotics Law Enforcement. They're based out of Kabul. The Gender Justice Program is based out of Kabul. We also have regional... in fact, that was my position over there, was a regional justice advisor. I was based in Gardez in Paktia province. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a very important issue, especially in Afghanistan. A moment ago, though, when you're talking about interpreting laws and so forth, moving, you know, at least secular laws as opposed to religious laws, I would also like to point out that at least in Afghanistan, that infrastructure is it may exist in some places, in other places it doesn't exist. A lot of the people there will rely on traditional. Tribal forms of justice, and as far as interpreting, you know, a laws, you know, a divorce law or something like that about who gets what, I would say you can't put the, you know, the cart before the horse kind of thing. You need to establishing some infrastructure in Afghanistan is really the number one priority right now.
Well, thank you for that call, Oliver. And how about our on-air producer puts you on hold after this, and we'll take maybe your email or something. And if our guests want to get in touch, they can do it that way. But
I'd be happy just to, yeah, I can just, you know, I'd be happy just to give the information to your producer and she can provide it to.
Fantastic.
Ms. Mohibi. I guess what my question was whether or not Ms. Mohibi was aware of that program.
Rahila?
No, I wasn't actually aware of that program, but I've actually applied for a lot of U.S. contract jobs that I can go back to Afghanistan for a year and work and then come back for my master's. So I wanted to take a year gap. But
yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't get any response, and also because I don't have a U.S. citizenship, I don't know how that works with the security and everything, yeah.
Well, good luck going back. They need you there, so...
Mm.
I need them too.
Well, I'm glad you guys were able to connect. And Oliver will go ahead and put you on hold right now. And we need to take another break right now. And then we'll continue our conversation this morning with Aziza Alhibre, who is a founder of law, or professor of law at the T.C. Williams School of Law at the University of Richmond. And she founded the organization we're discussing this morning. It's called Karama. It's a Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights group, founded in 1993, and she currently serves as its president. And also speaking this morning with Rahila Muhibi, who founded the 100 Mothers Literacy Program in Afghanistan in 2008 to educate women in her home village. And she's also a participant in the Karama program as well. And I should say, if you're interested in more information on Karama, you can go to their website. It's karamah.org, karamah.org. And we welcome your phone calls this morning as well to tell us how you think maybe women are perceived, Muslim women are perceived in Western cultures, as in America and Europe, and what changes you think are happening and need to be happening on both sides of the fence here. And if you have any questions about Karama specifically, you can call us up at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this morning at 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller will be in to taste test some delicious Wisconsin artisan cheeses. His guest is Jeannie Carpenter of Oregon, Wisconsin, creator of the organization Wisconsin Cheese Originals. That's Larry Mueller's show coming up at 11 o'clock this morning. Right now, we're talking with Aziza Alhibre. She is the founder of the group Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights. It's a charitable educational organization focusing on the domestic and global issues of human rights for Muslim women. Also this morning, we're speaking with Rahila Muhibi, who is a participant in the Karama program and the founder of the 100 Mothers Literacy Program, which she created in 2008 to educate women in her home village in Afghanistan. And I think we have, do we still have Rahila with us? We'll check on that. I think maybe we lost her over the break. But Aziza Alhibre, I want to ask you about the recent election protests in Iran and the role of women there. I think that caught a lot of people's attention because there were so many young women involved in those protests out on the streets. What did you make of that?
Well, to be honest with you, I do not have a fuller picture of what happened in Iran. I'm not sure that there were also similar young women on the other side of what was happening. I am not surprised by active Iranian women. In fact, if you look at the tradition, Iranian women have always been very active, very educated, and many of them worked. And in fact, even in the early days of the Islamic Republic, some women applied, at least one woman applied for the title of Ayatollah. And some women got together and started developing gender equitable Islamic jurisprudence. So we have not been in touch with them at Karama because of the political situation between the U.S. and Iran. But we know of their existence, and we know that they have been trying to do really good work, these women. I don't know the extent to which their jurisprudence has developed. But we know that at one point, somebody in the parliament proposed a bill in which the women would be paid for their housework. And I understand that that bill did not pass. But a lot has been happening on both sides of the political fence in Iran, and it does not surprise me at all.
Well, a few months ago, Barack Obama, he spoke at a mostly Muslim crowd in Cairo, and I don't know if you're familiar with what he said there, but I gather there was a lot of enthusiasm over some of the content in the speech. For example, he said, "I've come here to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based upon mutual interest and mutual respect." What is the sense of the leadership in Karama about how the United States will play a role in what you're trying to do right now?
Well, we were very pleased by that statement. We actually issued a press release, which your audience would, your listeners will find on our website. We think it was a very thoughtful statement to address to the Middle East, which is very concerned about issues of respect and so on. We hope that the president will move forward and through in various ways follows up on that statement. I would like to mention to you as a side note something which is really interesting, because we thought the talk was extremely good. But if you remember, there was a mention in it about the position of the U.S. government and veiled women in the U.S., which is that, you know, this is a country where we have freedom of conscience, and that should not be a problem in the U.S. I forget the exact statement he used.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the women in Europe did not like that reference because they wanted to stress on education. You know, because the veil in Europe has been used to keep the Muslim women out of school. And what they're trying to argue for is that if you are really trying to help us, put us in schools, don't kick us out because we're veiled. So I just wanted to show you how in different cultures,
right,
the response to the same statement might be different.
Rahila Muhibi, do you have a sense of how that speech was taken among women in Afghanistan?
When the speech was given in Cairo, I was in United States. I'm still in United States, but I was here. But a lot of my friends that I'm in contact with, and that they live in Afghanistan right now, they're very glad that a U.S. President like Barack Obama, he is very much well informed with the Quranic values of Muslim Islam, unlike the stereotypical judgment or interpretation of the West towards Islam as well, because I think the Muslim world is really much, very much sandwiched between the extreme interpretation of Quran, and then that interpretation of Quran is so much reflecting to the judgments of non-Muslim world as well. So the moderate good Muslims that they are in between, there was so much sandwich between these two forces, and that was very a positive thing among my friends, that they were very happy at how the verses were used in his speech, and how he knew a lot about the principles of Quran.
May I mention one more thing about that speech?
Sure.
I think one important thing that we highlighted in our press release is that the president moved away from the theory of conflict or clash of civilizations to the theory of dialogue of civilizations. And that opens up the door quite wide for different civilizations to learn from each other. And that's what we were hoping for.
Was it strong enough for you? What are you hoping to hear from him that maybe you haven't heard yet?
I think what we would like to hear from him is more interaction with American Muslims. I think that would, that would make quite an impact. For example, visiting the Islamic Center in Washington that every president has visited in the past, meeting with wider sectors of the community and so on. And I think it will happen. The president has just been hit with so many issues that he needed to deal with. And at one point, I think he will deal with this one.
I wonder if you would mind telling us a story or two of one of the women in Karama who has taken the leadership and, you know, the confidence building, all of that that you are providing, and gone on to make a change in their home country.
Oh, yeah, I would be happy to give you two stories. One of them, we had a very quiet woman that came to us from Belgium, and we were told that, you know, she's a really good leader, you should have her in your program, and we did. And then I went a year later to follow up on, to visit the country and follow up on the women. And I found out that she has instituted her own educational program for Belgian women there to give them the confidence that she got. So she was highly productive in that regard, and I was so taken aback because I never thought that she would be doing something like that. Her friend, who also came to the program, was a veiled woman, and she told me that she had a real problem believing that because she's veiled, she could never get a good job in her country, in Europe. And therefore, she stuck to a job that she really hated because she was afraid if she leaves it, she'll never get another one. After she came to Karama, and we have no problem, you know, people get to choose for themselves whether they are going to be veiled or not. It's not our business. She gained confidence in herself as a person. And she told me a year later that she decided that It's not the veil or the lack of it that makes the person. It's who she is on the inside. And she really started believing that she is really capable and had quite a bit of confidence. So she went back, she quit her job, and she interviewed for other jobs. And she was so confident the way she presented herself that she got an excellent job she was very happy with. So I'm glad we were able to help her.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you see the veil as a political problem for Muslim women?
What do you mean, political problem?
As a source of prejudice from I guess, Westerners who are not used to seeing women in veils.
Well, yes. Actually, there is a case in Michigan now where there are different types of veils. In this case, the woman covered her face, not only her head. And the judge prevented her from being a witness in his courtroom unless she removes the veil off her face. So that's really like a civil rights issue. And Karama has no position on the veil, but we have a position on constitutional issues. So we see across the country that in some places it's not a hindrance. In another, it's starting to be a problem where certain laws are being passed to restrict veiled women. I think we need to just let people be and not worry too much about whether somebody has something on their head or not. I mean, nuns wear or used to wear the nun's habit, and it was not a problem. And some people wear hot pants, and it's not a problem. So we should leave this alone. We are America, and we let people, you know, let a million flower bloom, right?
And there have been leaders, I guess it's more of a problem in Europe, where there have been various European leaders who've said it's a sign of oppression.
Sarkozy said that.
What do you do when a leader says something like that?
Well, Sarkozy, in his statements, and we do have a press release on that we did not yet circulate too broadly, but it has been circulated and it might be on our website. What Sarkozy said goes against not only our constitutional rights in the United States, but also international human rights. And he needs to look at what he said more carefully. We are opposed to the French way of doing business, and we hope that the rest of Europe will look to the way things have been done in the United States, which are a lot more equitable and more consistent with international human rights. There is also some sort of inconsistency in the way the French talk. They say they would like to protect the Muslim women, and that is why they're preventing them from going to school with a veil. I think they're giving them a double jeopardy. First of all, the society is discriminating against them because of their veil, and now they're told they cannot go to school. You know, if you really believe in women, let them go to school and get the education. Mm. And if you think that the veil has been forced upon them by their parents, then the best solution is to educate them, help them grow up and stand up and be independent and take the decision they want. So there is, I think, an inconsistency in the French position, plus a violation of international human rights.
I want to take one more phone call before we hit the top of the hour here. We've got John joining us from West Salem. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed the show. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
If a person were to buy a book to get an objective interpretation of Islamic Muslim law, what would you suggest? Something that's not really biased in either way.
Well, let me suggest, from my biased perspective, because nobody is not biased, right? We all come to the table with our baggage. I suggest that you go to our website, the karama.org website, and look at the section called articles. The reason I say that is that a lot of the articles we write and publish are published in law reviews or law journals because they tend to be jurisprudential. And that's why they're not in public circulation. You don't see them on the shelf in a bookstore. But they are really the heart and the core of what we do. And if you look at them, some of them are quite accessible to the general reader, and Muslim women read those all the time and benefit from them. I think that will give you a very good view of what Islam is about, especially the article which has in the title The Global Village. I don't remember the whole title. But I suggest if you start there, you will get a really good picture.
Okay, thank you, John, and good luck looking for that. And again, the website is karama.org. It's K-A-R-A-M-A-H www.thefreedomfighters.org. And we're running out of time here, but I wonder if I could ask you both what maybe your dearest hope is in terms of progress down this road that you're both working on with Karama in the next, say, 5 or 10 years. And why don't we start with you, Rahila?
I would like to really expand my project, Candid Mother's Literacy Program, and work on, towards human rights and also women's rights. And I think it's not only women's rights, but we also need to educate our dear males in Afghanistan and tell them that this is not the case. The case is that we all are equal, and also teach the women their rights and the males dear, tell them not to, and educate them as well. So that's my hope, my future hope.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for being with us. And Aziza, we've got about 30 seconds left for you.
We'd like to have branches around the world so that the local women could be speaking in their own voice and that their voices are not coming from the U.S. We also would like to have our summer program extended around the year and have an institute to which women from all over the world could come and get degrees in the Islamic studies that we offer.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us and to really wish you well with what you're doing here. It sounds like a wonderful program, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on. We've been talking with Aziza Al-Hibre and Rahila Muhibi, a recent graduate of Fayetteville, North Carolina, the Methodist University, the founder of the 100 Mothers Literacy Program. And Aziza Al-Hibre is the founder of Karama, the Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights. Thank you to Sarah Carroll for answering your phone calls this morning and to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. I'm Veronica Rickard, and it's great to have you listening along this morning right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.